wave their hands at before. This has had, for the linguists among you, it's had a terrible effect in linguistics. From about 1970 up till today, as the linguists will know, there's been a huge debate about the generative capacity of different kinds of grammatical theories. You know, like, do they generate all recursively enumerable sets? Or can we cut them down so that they generate only recursive sets? Or can we cut them down so they have only the capacity of context-free grammars, which is supposed to be a big ideal that you're supposed to try to reach? And in fact, a lot of the argument against so-called transformational grammar, since work by Stan Peters, or even earlier, Hilary Putnam, has been that it's too broad and weak generative capacity, generates too many sets, it generates wild sets, you know, and we don't want that. We want it to generate only non-wild sets. Now, I call this a debate, but it's really one-sided, because only one position is being represented in the debate, those who think it's a problem. The other side, which is basically me, isn't participating because there's no problem, because there's no question. There's no question. You can't talk about generative capacity unless you have a class of well-formed formulas. And there is no such thing. Nobody's ever told us what it is. You know. Nor is there any gap in linguistic theory that would be filled if you had such a concept. I mean, it's not that there's a kind of a theory out here and, you know, there's some things we'd like to explain, and if we could only figure out this concept, we could explain them. That's not true. I mean, there's nothing around which we would understand any better if somebody specified the class of well-formed formulas, and furthermore, nobody knows how to do it. Furthermore, every working linguist, here, get back to Luigi's point, every working linguist knows at least on one side of his brain that it doesn't make any sense, because working linguists are typically working in areas of relative judgment. Like, the most productive work has to do with things like the differences between subjacency deviations and ECP deviations, you know, two kinds of deviation. That's, you know, what's going to be useful evidence. You never know in advance. It's usually something very exotic, not what's in front of you. And that evidence turns out, for all kind of theoretical reasons, to be extremely illuminating. Or takes the study of parasitic gaps, certain kind of construction, which are very odd. You know, when you tell them to people, they kind of cringe. Although they interpret them in very special ways. Now, you know, the ways they interpret them are extremely illuminating. In fact, precisely because they're very odd. They're very odd because nobody ever hears them. So any way they're interpreting is something that's coming out of their minds. You know? So they happen to be very interesting, but they're all deviant. Well, are they well-formed or aren't they well-formed? Well, it's a stupid question, you know. They have exactly the status they have, you know. The status they have is deviant in this respect. There is no notion of well-formedness. Now, every working linguist knows that in their bones, you know. No one has ever given a vague idea what the class of well-formed formulas might be. There's no gap in linguistic theory that is asking to be filled by this concept. In other words, the concept has all the earmarks of being totally absurd. Yet there's a huge literature based on it and claiming that there are all sorts of problems because weak generative capacity is too large, or, you know, quantum-type indeterminacy problems and so on. That seems to be really a paradigm example of irrationality coming from misunderstood mathematical analogies, which aren't analogies. I mean, actually, I think there's similar things back to Frege. But the model of formal arithmetic is just irrelevant. You know, it's not at all like natural language. Formal mathematical languages are languages only by metaphor. You know, like the bee language is a language. You can use the metaphor, like, they don't have any of the properties of natural language. It is. Well, I'd like to come back to that, actually, after giving some examples. I mean, it seems to me that from the very start, there were some very funny moves made with regard to, I mean, people tried to, you know, they were trying to get out of behaviorism, but I think they fell right back into it. They fell right back into it in another direction by setting up operational criteria that defined categories of intelligence. So take say Herbert Simon, who's really one of the great figures of the field. I mean, actually won the Nobel Prize for this kind of stuff. He pointed out once in his autobiography, he points out, and he's quite right, that chess playing, the problem of chess playing, is he called it the Drosophila of cognitive science, meaning it's played the same role in cognitive science that Drosophila played in genetics. It's the core problem around which everything revolved. You wanted to solve the problem of Drosophila, that led to genetics. You wanted to solve the problem of chess playing, that led to cognitive science. And he's kind of right about that. I mean, people take it very seriously. And there's a lot of work on it, a lot of money goes into it, and so on. Back in the 50s, when this stuff got started, my view was, and I still hold this view, that this is total nonsense. Total and absolute nonsense. It doesn't make the slightest bit of difference whether you can get an algorithm that'll defeat Kasparov, or whoever it was in those days. The only purpose in working on this topic is if you want to take the fun out of playing chess. I mean, it's about as interesting as trying to show that you can build a bulldozer that'll dig a hole faster than a person. Yeah, probably you can. But it's not going to tell you anything. It's not going to tell you anything about human beings. And for reasons that every natural scientist knows, I mean, it has to do with the nature of simulation. You don't do simulation in order to try to beat the original. You do simulation in order to try to learn something about the original. Okay? So, like, if somebody came along and said, the way to study human physical capacity is to build bulldozers because they can dig holes faster than people can, that would be a joke. I mean, there would be a point in studying, some digging machine, for a scientist at least, if it was going to teach you something about how humans dig. You just want to dig faster, it's an engineering problem. It has nothing to do with the sciences. A chess playing program would be interesting if it would tell you something about how people play chess. Actually, in my opinion, even that wouldn't be interesting. And the reason is that how people play chess is not an interesting problem. Now, interesting is a funny notion. What is it of interest for the sciences is something something's interesting for the sciences if it's on the borders of current understanding. If it's way out away from the borders of current understanding, it's just not interesting, no matter what's going on. Now, chess playing is not on the borders of current understanding. I mean, it's some very, in fact, the reason chess is a game is because people are no good at it. If everybody was good at it, it wouldn't be a game. The things that we're good at are things like talking. You can't have, a thing like they just had in Yugoslavia where people speak sentences to each other and understand each other. The trouble is every three-year-old can do that, So you make up this, in fact, games and sports altogether are designed to be things that people are no good at all, So therefore, abilities separate and scatter, and only freaks can do it, like, say, pole vaulting. I mean, they don't have a walking, you don't have a walkie. You see if people can walk from here to there in the Olympics, but you do see if they can pole vault, because it's some totally insane activity that nobody is any good at, and therefore abilities scatter, and only certain people can do it, and in fact only pretty freaky people can do it. So you can have sports and competitions and so on. Well, chess is like that. It's a game because we're absolutely no good at it. It's probably around the outer edges of the problem space. Now, it's not a mystery or we'd be in real trouble, but it's not central to the problem space, and therefore it's a game. So therefore, and it doesn't make sense. Like, if you were studying human physiology and somebody said, look, I want to study pole vaulting. I mean, what people actually study is how I can reach over here and pick up that glass. That's unsolved. Like, how can I build a robot arm that'll duplicate what I do with it, tied to a visual system that'll do what I do when I pick up that glass? That's an interesting problem because it's around the borders of understanding. But if someone were to come along and say, I want to study pole vaulting, people would laugh. It's not worth studying. We don't even know how you can reach and pick up a glass. So who cares about pole vaulting? And the same is true of chess. I mean, it's so far from what we understand that it's not even worth studying. But if for some crazy reason, I think it's crazy, somebody wanted to study it, then they would only be interested in a chess-playing algorithm if, in fact, it taught you something about how people play chess. But it was obvious in the 1950s that that's not where it was going to go. The chess-playing algorithms that were going to win the prizes were those that used the capacities of computers, which are completely different than humans. I mean, they use rapid search, for example. So the guys who win the prizes now are people who explore some search space, you know, at very super speeds down to 10 moves, you know. Well, a human being can't begin to do that. I mean, not even begin. Humans do it in a totally different way, however it is. So, you know, winning the chess championship, like what gets the money in the articles in the science magazines, is like building a bigger bulldozer. And if that's the Drosophila for cognitive science, it really tells you that cognitive science is way off on the wrong track. And it starts from the very beginning. And I think it's because of a kind of behavior, lingering behaviorism, which showed up as the idea that intelligence is whatever satisfies a certain operational criterion. And if the operational criterion is playing a decent game against a grandmaster, we study that. But the natural sciences have nothing like that. In the natural sciences, there are no operational criteria. Like, nobody sets up an operational criterion for something being a liquid, you know, like it feels wet or something like that. I mean, that's, you can set up any operational criterion you like. They're a dime a dozen. They don't mean anything. You're interested in looking at, you know, trying to discover those phenomena that lead you to understanding. Now, it's interesting that when you go back to the 17th and 18th century, people, the simulation that was done then was scientific. So when Vaucanson constructed a duck that was digesting, he wasn't trying to fool people into thinking it was a duck. He was trying to learn something about digestion. In fact, he purposely made it transparent for that reason. That's quite different than modern cognitive science and the modern concept of simulation, which is basically an effort to fool people, see if a machine can fool people. I think it's going back way before that. I mean, it's going back to some primitive period that the Cartesian Revolution escaped. Because already in the 17th and 18th century, the concept of simulation was understood the way it's understood in the modern sciences. The guys who were constructing these automata were not trying to fool people into thinking it was a person or a duck or something. They were trying to say, what can I learn about a duck from this automaton? That's the way people construct the model of, you know, the heavens or something. It's not the way people do cognitive science. I think this is a regression to the pre-scientific era. And as for the reasons, I think it's a link. I don't think, I said that there was a move away from behaviorism, but I don't really believe it. There was an effort to move away from behaviorism, but it fell right back into it in an even worse sense than behaviorism, namely the attempt to satisfy operational criteria. That's the role that the Turing test plays in contemporary cognitive science. I'll come back to this in more detail, but that's what I think. I don't know. I mean, I have no theory about it. My only theory about it is it's probably a mystery. I mean, phenomenally, it looks like a mystery. The phenomenon of confronting free will looks to me like the way a rat would probably feel if it was facing a right, left maze. Something's going on out there, but it can't figure out what it is. You know, the phenomena looks so obvious that it's hard to deny them. I don't think it's got anything to do with indeterminacy. I mean, Well, like, take, say, Roger Penrose, you know, sort of leading quantum physicist. He argues that quantum physics is wrong, is, you know, hasn't really, is a tentative, it's a temporary theory, hasn't quite reached the truth. And when it reaches the truth, it'll explain the mind. Well, I don't know. You know, I'm not enough of a scientist to judge what he's saying, but I don't see any reason to believe that. It doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere near the question. Quantum indeterminacy seems to have totally different properties. It's no more relevant than classical determinacy. As for Priestley, he was just making a common sense, I think he was making a common sense observation. He was saying, look, since there's no matter around anymore, because Newton got rid of it, things like the power of attraction and repulsion, which we don't understand in his day, and electricity and magnetism, which we don't understand, and human thought, which we don't understand, are just properties of organized matter. And we've got to try to understand them in parallel ways. As to how to understand them, it's the kind of thing that you never know until you've done it. You know, it doesn't make much sense speculating about how it'll work out. The only thing that's worth speculating about, I think, is whether some of these questions are in the mystery space for humans, which they might be. And about that, we could conceivably learn something. They do have that feel. And in fact, I think Colin McGinn is basically correct in saying that most philosophical problems have that feel. Problem of consciousness, for example, is one, you can't deny. I mean, there are people who deny that people are conscious or who claim that thermostats are conscious. But, you know, that just seems ridiculous. I mean, it just seems an obvious truth. But nobody has the foggiest idea about how organized matter could have this property. There are lots of bad books about the subject which claim to have solved it. But if you look at them, they haven't done anything. They've just restated the problem. When you're using those terms in a kind of a Foucault-like sense. Yeah. Yeah. I can't really comment on that stuff because I don't understand a word of it, to tell you the truth. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Let me start with a personal confession of inadequacy. When I read anything that starts with post, you know, post-structuralism, post-modernism, post-anything else, my eyes glaze over. I don't understand it, you know. When I say I don't understand it, I mean, not that I don't get some kind of a feeling from it, you know. I sort of get a kind of a feel of what Foucault's talking about, and often not even that, but I have no cognitive understanding of it. Furthermore, I'm just evading the question for that reason. And just to continue with personal inadequacy, it's lack of understanding of a very special kind. I mean, there's lots of things I don't understand. Like, you know, I take the last issue of Physical Review, let's say, and I open it. I'm not going to understand one word of any article there. However, that's different. It's different in two respects. One respect is I know I can go over to my friend in the physics department and say, look, can you tell me what this is about at my level of, you know, foolishness and lack of knowledge? And they can do it. You know, a good physicist can tell you, yeah, it's sort of about this, you know, and skip this step, and here's the problem, and you can get to understand it. So, like, say, take Roger Penrose. When he writes about quantum physics, he's skipping all kind of steps. He's not telling you what a tensor is and, you know, all sorts of things, but you can kind of understand it, you know. Now, in the case of post-X, nobody can explain it to me. I mean, you know, when somebody explains it to me, I'm just as confused as before. The other thing is that in the case of other hard things, I know there's a path that I could follow to get to understand it. And in some cases where I've been particularly interested, like, say, Foundation of Mathematics, I've done it. You know, I'm not really good at it, but I can sort of follow it. And in this case, I wouldn't even know how to start, you know. I look at these pages, and it's just, I could look at it forever, and I'd never make any progress. And nobody can help me. So it's a different kind of lack of understanding. And therefore, I'm just sort of off in outer space as far as this stuff is concerned. I don't, and hence, that's why I'm evading the question. I mean, not only do I not comprehend it, I don't know how to go about comprehending it. Some people seem to, but maybe there's a genetic difference or something. Maybe it's like being tone, could be, it's kind of like being tone deaf. You know, if you're tone deaf, there's certain things you just can't hear. I can't hear this stuff. Well, I mentioned before that Tom Kuhn is an old friend of mine, and one thing we've disagreed about over the years is about paradigm shifts. I mean, in my opinion, there's been about two of them in the whole, all of human intellectual history. I mean, there was, you know, the Galilean-Newtonian revolution, there was quantum theory, and I don't know, maybe, if, I don't even think evolutionary theory counts, it's too simple, you know. Maybe there are others, but if so, I don't see them. I mean, people talk about paradigm shifts all the time. I remember not long ago reading an article about this by a linguist, guy was in Berlin, I forget. He was writing kind of a history of modern linguistics, and there was a paradigm shift about every 3 weeks, you know. But, you know, I don't see any. I mean, the shifts are so small, you know, that it's really kind of reconstructing old ideas and understanding them a little better. Maybe with new technical understanding or something or other. So it seems to me the terms like paradigm shift are kind of too inflated for the sort of thing that most of us do. It's all what Kuhn would call normal science. He doesn't agree with this, I should say. And, you know, you got to take him seriously. He invented the story. But it's a question of where what orders of magnitude seem to you to be important. And people just have different judgments about this. Well, let me mention Penrose again, who's interesting. He divides theories into three types, what he calls superb, useful, and tentative. And his level is so inflated that thermodynamics doesn't make it beyond useful. And contemporary particle theory doesn't even make it to useful. Okay, well, you know, if those are your standards, then we're somewhere else, you know, in some other world. You know. But all the talk about, the fact of the matter is there have been only, I think, a few real changes in the way people have looked at things. And those really are paradigm shifts. And they're hard, they're difficult, you know. They're difficult to comprehend. They require a complete revising of the way you think about everything. It just doesn't seem to happen in other fields. The changes are small. We don't understand enough.